danger. I think that he is fighting for his political life, and I think he deserves it. I think that his lack of willingness to look at people in our neighborhoods as valuable, as people that can actually make a contribution to Chicago, is racist, is arrogant. It has caused pain and suffering in people's lives. People have it harder than they did before he came in office. And, you know, that should not be acceptable. We don't envision a world. We don't have some unrealistic view of a colorblind society. But we should have a colorful society. We should have a society where I shouldn't have to apologize for being who God made me. I shouldn't have to act as if I'm not proud to be black and still be able to work with Greg Jobin Leed, still be able to work with Day Hernandez, his brothers and sisters who respect what we each bring to the table. That's the world we're fighting for.
Before,
and that's not the city or the world that he comes from.
Before we end, I want to bring Day Hernandez into this conversation with agitarte, which is like agit art in English. You collaborated in When We Fight, We Win in a most magnificent way. I mean, this book is unique in the way it is framed by the art. Describe why this is so important and some of these images in your book.
In the recognition of art and culture as an essential part of building the movements, Agitarte is an organization where I'm a resident artist, and Agitarte is an organization made up of artists who are committed to creating projects and practices of cultural solidarity with workers and marginalized communities in grassroots struggles. And our work in When We Fight, We Win was definitely creating that art narrative, recognizing that most often we forget that the narratives are controlled by those in power, and that there's certainly art and culture created within the communities of amazing souls and amazing artists who, hand by hand with activists, are changing those narratives and creating a new culture where we can create that liberation.
Or one of the freedom. People you collaborated with also made one of the big bread and puppet-like art pieces in the Climate Justice March. Describe that of Mother Earth.
Yeah.
That became the image of the march.
So that one in particular we created with El Puente, with El Cadre Folks from El Puente in Brooklyn, also an organization that's been based on more than 40 years in Los Sures. And the giant puppet, more than 14 feet, and it's actually our biggest puppet, was created in, I would say, like 2 weeks. And we wanted the face of we were thinking of the Pachamama, so a resemblance of Mother Earth, but also a resemblance of all the single mothers and brown and black bodies that are raising. Mm-hmm.
Well,
children.
Before we go, Greg, you're traveling the country now. Tonight, you're going to be premiering, launching the book at Powerhouse Arena in Brooklyn and Dumbo, a big multimedia display, art, stories. And where do you go from here, from Brooklyn to Boston?
So 7 p.m. tonight at Powerhouse. We'll be in Cambridge on Thursday at 7 p.m. at Harvard Books. We'll be in D.C. At Busboys and Poets at on Tuesday the 12th. We're back in Boston. Then we go to Chicago, Seattle,
Your website
Portland,
is?
And When We Fight, We Win. WhenWeFightWeWin.org and
as you bring together movements all over this country, once again, the very movements you documented. I want to thank you all for being with us. Greg Jobin Leeds, Day Hernandez, G2 Brown in Chicago, and Isabel Souza Rodriguez. Best of luck on your journey. The book, again, When We Fight, We Win, 21st Century Social Movements and the Activists That Are Transforming Our World. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gattas-Diener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, Pedro Rodriguez, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, engineer. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:04. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today we'll talk about another situation down in Burns, Oregon, where some heavily armed, self-proclaimed patriots have taken over a federally owned remote bird sanctuary in their bid to take America back from public ownership.
We are trying to evolve at Religion for Life.
And now, we as humans find ourselves as agents of evolution. It's no longer natural selection, it's now actual selection.
This week I speak with Steve McIntosh, the author of The Presence of the Infinite, the spiritual experience of beauty, truth, and goodness. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
She's dying to evolve.
The KBOO Community Radio Artist in Residence program assists artists working creatively with sound. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The goals of the KBOO Artist Support Program are to support and invest in individuals who are pushing themselves artistically using sound, whose work will impact the cultural landscape of Portland, and to bring those artists into the dynamic KBOO community of local, national, and international artists and activists. Applications for the 2016 KBOO Artist in Residence are due February 12th at 5 p.m. More information and application materials are at kboo.fm/AIR2016.
I'm a flag-waving patriotic nephew of my Uncle Sam, a rough-riding, fighting Yankee man. I love mom and apple pie and the freedoms that we all enjoy across this beautiful land. I worked hard and I'd fight hard for the old red, white, and blue, and I'll die a whole lot harder if it comes to where I have to. I'm a flag-waving patriotic nephew of my Uncle Sam, a rough-riding, fighting Yankee man. And when I see old glory waving, I think of all the brave men who have fought and died for what is right and wrong. And when I see old glory burning, my blood begins to churning, and I could do some fighting of my own. I don't believe in violence, I'm a God-fearing man, but I'd stand up for my country just as long as I could stand. 'Cause I'm a flag-waving patriotic nephew of my Uncle Sam, a rough-riding, fighting Yankee man.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. You can find it on the internet tubes at kboo.fm. My name is Abe Proctor. We'll be joined shortly by my erstwhile partner and co-host, Joe Uris, who, it must be noted, did the responsible thing and walked to the station this morning because of hazardous inclement conditions. So he will be with us in just a few moments. Today, we're going to talk about something that you probably have heard about. Amy Goodman talked about it at length on her show just a little while ago. And that is the fact that 20-odd heavily armed patriots, real Americans, it occupied a complex of buildings at a federal wildlife refuge in Eastern Oregon, ostensibly to effect change in the way that the federal government administers lands in the Western United States, and even perhaps to put an end to the fact that the federal government administers lands at all. What's notable about this standoff, as I just mentioned, are the fact that there's guns. There are guns.
Guns.
Guns. Joe, you're here.
I'm here. I walked.
Good for you, man.
Through the ice.
Through the ice. Through the, snow. Uphill. Both ways.
Through the buses. Through the trains.
All right. All right. So we're going to talk about this standoff.
Standoff.
In Eastern Oregon.
Eastern Oregon.
Because it's really interesting, and it's of a piece with a whole bunch of things that have happened in recent American conservative political history, particularly since the election of Barack Obama. So I wanted to get into this a little bit and why it's of a piece with these other trends. And I also want to examine the elephant in the room here. And in order to do that, I want you gentle listeners to consider this fact. What might the reaction of authorities be if these armed occupiers were black? I just want you to think about that for a minute.
I'm not going to think about it.
Okay.
That. They'd all be dead.
Also, before we get on to today's primary conversation, I want to make sure that people are aware that there's a public hearing today on the proposed Tesoro Savage Oil Terminal, the one that's being proposed to be built in Washington on the other side of the Columbia. That's from 1 o'clock p.m. to as late as 11 p.m. tonight, with a rally at 5 p.m. at the Clark County Event Center in Ridgefield, Washington. If you get to the Clark County Event Center, you want to take exit 9.
And I have to add that the ice is melting very fast. The freeways are clear. Main streets are clear. If you were planning to go and you're thinking, oh, the weather, you don't have to worry. It's clear.
Good.
Raining, actually.
Exit 9 off Interstate 5. More information at 350pdx.org. So a bunch of yahoos took over a wildlife refuge in Eastern Oregon, Joe. Why?
Well, okay. First of all, the naive answer is, well, the federal government owns all of the land in the West, and it's just keeping it there for so that the deer and the antelope can play.
Well, that's true as far as it goes.
That's true as far as it goes, and it doesn't go very far. The reality is that these vast tracts of land in the West, for the most part, are not readily prove outable in terms of farming and so on. Historically, those lands were available to farmers and to ranchers who wanted to prove them out in the old system of giveaways of land. But at the turn of the century, beginning particularly with Teddy Roosevelt, large tracts of beautiful, beautiful scenery, beautiful lands, unique lands, special lands, were set aside for the public. Now, this is important, for the public, not for the government, but for the public to enjoy and to appreciate and eventually, conceivably, to become a vital resource in event of something like climate change.
Indeed. So the federal government owns about 30% of the land in the United States.
Yes.
There is federally owned land in each of the 50 states.
Yes.
But most of it is west of the Missouri River. Most of it's in what we conceive of as the American West, which
I
suppose is actually the American West. About 650 million acres. These include national parks and monuments, as you mentioned, national forests, wildlife refuges like the one currently being occupied by these armed people. Lands administered by the Bureau of Land Management, military lands, of course, and Native American reservations. How did this all come into the possession of the United States government? Well, a number of ways, as it turns out. Land was ceded by Native American tribes, either by way of treaty or it was taken by force. Land was acquired from other European governments, either by force or by purchase. And most of this land was eventually given back over to private or corporate interests in the form of land grants for railroads under the Homestead Acts, which is now expired, and under something called the Taylor Grazing Act, which has a particular bearing on what's going on today, the Taylor Grazing Act of 1934, which was essentially to stop the tragedy of the commons that was happening on land on which cattle and other livestock were being grazed. Now, what's a tragedy of the commons, you might ask?
Yeah, what is a tragedy of the commons?
Tragedy of the commons describes a situation in which a publicly held communal resource, like federal land in this case, acted upon by a bunch of individuals, all acting in their own enlightened self-interest, all acting independent of each other, managed to deplete and eradicate, in some cases, this common resource. Even when it's clear that it's not in everybody's best long-term interest. There's all a bunch of people acting independently, the collective impact of which leads to the ruination of this public resource. That's the tragedy of the commons.
Right. Well, and also, let's be realistic. If you are a rancher or a farmer, you've got to essentially show a profit. You've got to be able to deliver goods and services. You've got to be able to provide, for example, meat. That puts enormous pressure on you to overgraze.
Yes.
It's just a logical thing to do.
Yes.
Because you're looking to turn over your profit as quickly as possible.
Right.
And inevitably, capitalism being what it is, bad decisions get made.
Yeah. So the Taylor Grazing Act of 1934 took these federal lands that were being used as grazing land for livestock, divided them up into smaller parcels, and assessed fees for ranchers who wanted to lead their livestock onto these lands to eat. This was conceived as a means of better managing these communal lands so that they weren't overgrazed and ruined. Remember, this happened around the time of the Great Dust Bowl. So everybody was pretty cognizant of what happens when land is overused and overgrazed. So that's what happened here. So why are these people here, Joe? Can you tell
us why? Let's look at a couple of other things. During the great land booms, when railroads essentially were promoting the development of the West, owning land themselves, which they could resell, and lands being stolen from Native American peoples and so on, during that period of time, essentially, it was a great opportunity to become rich on land. Hmm. And many people with resources did exactly that. The railroads being the most notable.
Yeah.
The result of this was the creation of a lot of townships which didn't really have the necessities for survival. If you look at a map of Oregon from 1914, let's say, you'll see a lot of little towns that no longer exist. We call them ghost towns and we romanticize them. But in fact, these represent the destruction of the dreams of many, many people, particularly people coming to the United States, hoping for farmsteads where there is no likelihood that one can raise crops in the manner that these Europeans were used to. So it was a real disaster in that sense. However, their resources, the availability of water, the availability of beautiful, beautiful locations, the incredible wildlife, the unique qualities that make the American West so valuable to tourism, for example, did not in any way get affected by this, except in a very positive way. It meant that the lands were more or less left alone. However, the grazing laws, the allotments, allowed farmers and ranchers to graze cattle, frequently more cattle than they could or should graze on those very badly, potentially very badly managed lands. This has been a struggle in the West since the turn of since 1900.
Right. So we've got this system in place whereby if you want to use federal lands for whatever you want to use them for, you got to pay a fee, whether or not you're cutting down trees or if you're prospecting for oil or gas or if you're grazing your herd of cattle.
Right.
So let's fast forward to 2014. Southern Nevada, a guy by the name of Cliven Bundy, who, being an anti-government Westerner, has refused to pay his grazing fees for a long time. He's got a lot of cattle. He's got a big ranching operation, and he grazes these cattle to a large extent on federally administered lands in Nevada.
Well, in fact, he's overgrazing. That is a fact of his operation.
He's overgrazing. So he refused to pay his fees. He had done so for a long time on the grounds that the federal government had no constitutional right to administer these lands at all. So what happened?
Well, stop right there. That is just absolutely fictional.
It is absolutely fictional. He believes it, and so do the people who are occupying this wildlife refuge in Burns.
Including his son.
Including two of his sons.
Oh, yeah, you got another one,
too. Three of his sons.
Three of his sons.
This guy's got a lot of sons.
He's a real producer.
Yes, he is. So what happened in 2014? Well, the feds finally said, well, okay, you owe us all these back fees. You show no signs of paying. In fact, when we've asked you nicely, you've very not nicely said no. So they came in to seize this guy's cattle. What resulted was an armed standoff between Cliven Bundy, his family, and a growing number of supporters who poured in from the region with their guns and settled in to hold off with force any federal attempt to actually seize those cattle.
Well, in fact, they put up sniper posts and aimed high-powered rifles at federal authorities.
They did. They pointed guns at government employees.
Right.
Now, generally, pointing a gun at somebody is a crime, whether or not they happen to be a government employee. We should put that on the table right now as well.
Yeah.
So the end result here was essentially nothing, a stalemate, a standoff. Nothing happened to Clive and Bundy for flouting the federal land use regulation.
And one thing that did happen was he talked too much.
He did. Proved himself to be an ignorant, racist turd. Sorry, please continue.
At any rate, he and his family are part of a movement that is much larger than it would at first appear. There is all over the United States at this time in history, looking at everything from the presidential race with the fascist clown, the Nazi clown, Trump, and others. If you look at what's happening in the United States politics, both nationally and locally, there is a growing sense of frustration, rage, anger, and hatred for government itself.
Indeed.
And this captures that beautifully.
Yeah, this is of a piece with the Tea Party protesters who carried guns to anti-Obama rallies in the 2008 election and after. This is of a piece with the sort of fanatical nationalism embraced by figures like Sarah Palin, for example. This is all of a piece with what I really can't describe in any other terms but aggrieved white privilege.
I'm not sure I buy the sense of privilege that's involved. I think it in the end it is politically privileged, but in fact these people feel, and many of them are people who are not wealthy, who are struggling on land, who feel that the government is insensitive to their interests. Now, ironically, their legislators, many of them the New Age Republicans, not the Old Age Republicans, the New Age Republicans, are hell-bent on destroying any support for the small landholder, the small farmer, the small hard-working person, and so on. So you have all these forces, largely driven by a Congress that is absolutely unsympathetic to ordinary people's lives. Mm-hmm. You have these huge difficulties developing in the lives of ordinary people. During the 30s, the response to this kind of anger, which had a potential for fascism much greater perhaps than today because of the rise of Nazism and fascism in Italy and so on, in that situation, the federal government under Franklin Delano Roosevelt and a very supportive Congress changed things so that there were things like unemployment insurance, there was a minimum wage, all the things, all the guarantees that are so important, retirement benefits and so on, that are so important to life in America today. Now, all that is forgotten in the current situation. What instead is emphasized is a notion, and a very abstract notion, of American freedom and rugged individualism, romanticized to the point of absurdity, and supported by a lot of very, and I have to say this because there's no other word for it, ignorant, I don't know about their intellect, but otherwise I'd call them stupid people. And this is a really serious thing. This is not, you know, the Bundy, McBundy, whatever the hell, they go out there and they stand around with their guns, great replacements for their you-know-whats, and they are tougher than hell. They're rough, tough Westerners. And when you begin to talk to them, you discover they're not just Westerners, they're not just land defenders. They're fundamentally racist. They're fundamentally reactionary. They're fundamentally ignorant. And this ignorant behavior has been embraced and supported by what it didn't used to happen so much, the Republican Party. So you have a national quasi-fascist movement growing, pardon me, all over the country. It's very serious because people like this are so enraged, so outraged, so upset that they offer a potential for all kinds of bad things, violence to individual groups, violence to minorities, and apparently violence to the government. A terrible mistake was made in Nevada with the original standoff on the cattle. Mm-hmm. Those people should have, indeed, the government should have stood down, because what's the point of a firefight? But each of those people, as they left, should have been arrested, charged with using firearms to threaten federal and other peace officers, and face charges in the federal and state courts. That's what should have happened to them. The failure to do that, the just walking away from it that the federal government did, gave support and to a great degree authenticity to this movement. That's why these people now show up in Oregon, not particularly welcome, mm-hmm. I might add, in Burns of all places, to defend two guys who burned federal land and are now going back to jail. I don't happen to agree with, yeah, they're in jail today. I don't happen to agree with resentencing them. But that's not the point, because that is a due process question. The point is that these incredibly opportunistic land fighters mm-hmm. are willing to challenge the federal government effectively, believing the government is a paper tiger, and in essence, provoking the government, hoping for some kind of weird standoff, like the various standoffs that have taken place at Ruby Ridge and
Waco.
In Waco and places like that.
Well, one could also say that the government's restrained reaction in this situation and in the Clive and Bundy Nevada standoff was probably because they were afraid of the sort of blowback they got after the Waco and Ruby Ridge.
Well, yeah, and I think it was valid not to have an armed confrontation if you can avoid it.
Well,
but
absolutely.
There could have been,
yes. I think that goes without saying.
You know, warrants can be served after you've walked away.
All right, so let's run with that premise you just spun out there. It's valid to avoid an armed confrontation whenever possible. So that begs the question, why are these peace-loving patriots bearing arms in their occupation of this wildlife refuge?
Well, there's several reasons. There's, first of all, a certain kind of psychosis afoot in the
yes.
land. And this is important. There is a mass delusion about the nature of the government. Instead of perceiving the government as the instrument of the will of the people, which is pretty much what the Constitution says, they perceive the government as an intruder upon individual rights. These individual rights apparently have no borders, no limits. I can remember during the time when Obamacare was being pushed, there were a lot of signs showing Obama with a Hitler mustache. I can remember that there were tremendous numbers of people saying, hands off my Social Security, which wasn't even a part of the problem. And essentially, what I would...
Remember the sign that said, keep your government hands off my Medicare?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's...
There's a kind of ignorant, know-nothing crowd within the United States historically, now growing larger, supported... And this is what's really new and scary. Supported by an extremely opportunistic right-wing arm of the Republican Party.
Here's what really disturbs me and makes me worried. This segment of conservatism that you just described, very nicely, by the way, what worries me is this seeming willingness to undertake whatever means are necessary to achieve their ends. Their ends most often stated as the preservation of America as they understand it and as they conceive it to be. This is a fundamental difference mm-hmm. between conservatives and those of us on the left. We're not going to rallies with guns, and we are not espousing violence as a means to effect our ends.
I want to pull away the concept of conservative and liberal or left and right from this, because I think this is something a little different. This is truly a fascist movement. This is an argument that essentially says that the government is discredited and that a new government is needed. It is radical to the right. And is not the majority of the Republican Party, although you wouldn't know that to see the stupidity going on in the Republican Party right now. But it is the majority of the most vocal voices. When you have a psychotic land grabber like Donald Trump, who is the clown Hitler of all time, popularly responded to, when this goes on day after day, week after week, and the press gives him actual credit and legitimacy when he says just stupid things, things that are either half true or untrue. And when he just off the top of his head attacks women, off the top of his head attacks Mexican-Americans, off the top of his head does whatever the hell he feels like and is supported by his enormous egomaniacal wealth and power, when that happens, he becomes the leader of a movement of disenfranchised feeling people who are really not aware of either the Constitution and its meanings or of the notion of due process of states' rights and of federal rights. It's very scary.
It is very scary. I do think it's fundamentally conservative, but we can have that out here.
We can argue about what we mean by conservative would probably be where it gets down to. And that'll bore the hell out of our audience.
Yeah, probably so.
231-8187.
Speaking of our audience, yes, 231-8187 is the number to call. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. If you can't make a phone call, you can leave a comment on the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/Abe and Joe. Corey writes in to say, "These people are not patriots. These people are terrorists. This is not a peaceful protest. It stopped being peaceful the instant these guys said they were willing to kill to get their way.
Right.
If they were not white, the building they're occupying would already be nothing but a smoking foundation. Also, where are all the good guys with guns?" I think by that he's talking about in the context of arguing for a well-armed populace that good guys with guns will always step up and take care of the bad guys with guns. So that's a good question.
Well, first of all, the law enforcement community is, I think, handling this very, very well. The sheriff in Burns, the sheriff in the various counties, Mayor, et cetera, are saying essentially, look, we'll just wait for these guys to get bored. Mm-hmm. And leave. Now, whether or not it's decided by the feds, this is up to the FBI, really, whether or not it's decided by the feds that this invasion of federal land is and constitutes an invasion of the United States, literally, is an interesting question. All the federal government has to do is blockade them and wait. They'll be out of food in a month.
True. Let's take a phone call.
Yeah.
Who do we have? Dave, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, hey, well, you know, it's certainly true. If these are black or brown skinned people and it was a federal building in Portland, they would have been dead yesterday. And the feds, like Obama, are impotent because it's the white majority, and Obama leans to the white majority. He's impotent, and these guys, they're just a bunch of crybabies who want a handout. And they're going to be the first ones that cry out against socialism. We can't have socialism. But they're being able to raise their cattle on federal lands is a handout, and it's socialism. I have a commercial fishing operation in Alaska. Mm-hmm. I have to pay money to the government for the opportunity to fish. But I can't. That doesn't mean I can just go willy-nilly over federal lands. I can't park my equipment in the Forest Service. You know, and these guys, the other part of it is it's a racist thing. Where were these people, these white guys down there, when the Native Americans were being pushed off their land? Would you think they would have stood up to the Native Americans saying, no, we're not going to be pushed off their lands? Of course they wouldn't. And they're just looking for a handout. You know, if we had beet growers taking over the Forest Service, National Forest, they can't just grow their beets. They'd be pushed out. And, you know, this is just... they're just a bunch of crybabies down there. I'm sorry. I don't see what they just want a handout, you know. So I'll just leave with you that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, I can't really argue with that.
A crybaby. I don't know.
The fees in question here are really negligible. They're not very much. It really doesn't cost a whole lot if you're a rancher and you want to graze your cattle on federal land.
Well, but there is a limit on the number of cows per whatever the situation of that land is.
Yeah, so I think that just proves the caller right.
Yeah.
If these guys are bumping up against that limit and they're whining that they should have the right to do more, then yeah, they are just crybabies who want a handout.
Well, what began this thing in Burns, of course, was a decision by a farm family, unilateral decision, basically, to burn land, they argue, to prevent fires, you know, like backfires, to burn land so that but in the end it would, they assumed, and probably be true, produce more grass in time, thereby allowing them to graze more cattle. It was a violation of the law. It was arson on federal lands, and they were sentenced. Now, The question of whether they should have been sent back to jail, all of that I know nothing about and do not have an opinion on, except I don't like the idea that you go to jail and then you think you're done and then a federal judge somewhere decides, nah, you got to go back to jail. That's sort of confusing, but I don't know the I don't know the law. And it is neither the New York Times nor any other source that I've been able to find so far explains to me exactly what's going on, which is another problem. We no longer get accurate news information.
Yeah, this is true. But I want to challenge a statement that you just that you offered up a few moments ago, in that you thought that law enforcement was handling this very well and very appropriately.
In this case, not in the previous case.
What is an appropriate way to handle a takeover of federal property by armed individuals who they claim to be peaceful, but the fact that they're carrying guns would seem to belie that declaration?
Well,
so what is an appropriate way to deal with this situation? Is it simply okay for a group of people to walk into government land and take it over?
No, of course not. But the question is tactical. I'm assuming, and I don't know this to be true, that at some point, the FBI and the local sheriffs and so on will lose patience, and there may or may not be an armed confrontation. One of the things that is easy to do, obviously, is simply to wait these people out. It happens they're in a kind of a nice setting, and I don't know how much food they brought in and so on, but I don't know that I would allow them easy access in and out. I mean, maybe it's time for roadblocks. Maybe it's time once you're out, you're out. Once you're in, you're in. And I think that's the path I would go on, and then I would wait.
And what do you say to allegations that their response would be radically different were these people of color who had carried out this
There's no question about occupation. The fact that in this particularly racist society of ours, if these were Native Americans, which is the only group I can imagine in this situation, I look at what happened at Alcatraz and what happened in Wounded Knee, for examples, that the violence that would be perpetrated on the part of the government would be quite extreme. So, yeah. This is a situation where what you've characterized as white skin privilege, but I'll just call it, this is what European Americans can get away with, is the case here. And because the Nevada thing was handled so badly, where the government, where actually law enforcement officers were threatened by armed men who aimed high-powered rifles at them. And in fact, were presenting themselves as willing to die or kill for their cause. When you get in a situation like that, it's the appropriate thing, given that you're not defending Fort Knox or lives,
okay,
to withdraw.
Okay, so you've just conceded that what you've characterized as a rational law enforcement response is appropriate in this situation, and you've also conceded that this probably wouldn't happen if the group of people in question happened to be non-white.
Yeah.
And then you've sort of rolled that up and said that this is what European Americans can get away with. I would say that is the very definition of white privilege, what European Americans away with.
I will concede that this is about white privilege.
Okay, and I'll go further and say that this notion of aggrieved white privilege, of which these people are a pretty good embodiment, has taken over and now defines American conservatism. And it has found its focus and its outlet in figures like Donald Trump, and Ted Cruz.
Well, the clown Hitler certainly has inflamed these people and given them a kind of legitimacy that they otherwise wouldn't have. And the American press has gone along with that, no question about it. However, I want to go back to what happened in Nevada, because it is important. Indeed, the government should not have engaged in an armed conflict with these people. Waco, et cetera, are good warnings about that. However, as those people left, they could have been stopped. They could have been issued warrants. They could have been required to appear in court. They did violate federal law and state law. And they should have been prosecuted through a due process. That didn't happen, which I think emboldened these crazy people. So that part of it was poorly handled. Now, here's another opportunity to handle this in a better way. And I say, wait them out. When people leave, stop them, arrest them. For trespass, and throw them the hoosgow overnight, and they have a warrant, and they have to show up in a federal court in, well, probably Portland. I don't know where the nearest federal judge is in Eastern Oregon. That's just my ignorance.
Let's go to the phones. Mitch, good morning.
Hey, good morning. This is Mitch. Hi, Mitch.
Hi.
I would like you guys to step back for just a minute because there's actually a larger issue at stake here. And we're having a couple of liberal fallacies from my liberal friends, of which I'm one, but we should not be blinded by our values on equality, which certainly come into play here, and I can understand that. It turns out that my friends also have about as much of a fear of certain people as the conservatives have a fear of people. So the point I'm trying to make is that we no more terrorism. There is nothing to be gained by calling these people terrorists because existing criminal laws are sufficient to punish them to any degree that you want to punish them, especially if we talk about sedition. What this really does, when we rush to label these people as terrorists, what we're really doing is giving more power to the national security state to come in and redouble its force and extend its tentacles. There is a piece that was just published on a website called Shadowproof by one Kevin Gostola. And the title of it is "What's Wrong with Laughing and Calling Oregon's Militants Terrorists?" And I want to read to you what he said. He said, "The thrust behind these hashtags is that the white militants should be labeled as terrorists and law enforcement should recognize who they are dealing with are not patriots. But this serves the interest of the security state. To the extent that political support for wielding tools against people who are like these militants grows, the apparatus that perpetuates the war on terrorism to generate new tentacles. The reflexive view to view all developments, particularly those involving violence, through the lens of terrorism should be questioned rigorously, vigorously. The desire to label acts terrorism in order to bring some kind of equality to the application of force by law enforcement should be shunned as well." And here's his conclusion. Terrorism has no fixed meaning, as Chris Hedges has pointed out, I might add. It is a political term with tremendous propaganda value to the government when it is wielded. When we debate why this is not considered terrorism, this is a discussion that helps to sustain the status quo. It further enables the state to engage in authoritarian practices against the population. Instead of clamoring for the government to label white extremists as terrorists, the whole concept of terrorism should be made obsolete. Amen.
Okay, here's where I disagree with that statement. I think when folks on the left encourage the media and the government, thank you for your call, by the way, encourage the media and the government to call these white patriots terrorists, it's not because they want to invite some sort of commensurate violent response. It's to point out the innate hypocrisy with which the term terrorism is generally used. Generally, there's no hesitation to use that word and apply it to acts of violence carried out by non-white people, particularly non-white, non-Christian people. But there's this hesitation to label similar sorts of actions by white people by the same term. And again, this is not to invite more violent retribution from the government. This is to point out the essential hypocrisy of the war on terror. That's what I think.
Well, and I want to add something here that's really important. These labels, like, for example, terrorism, have always been used and abused. I think that this is not an issue about terrorism. This is an issue about criminal trespass on federal lands by individuals who argue falsely that they have a constitutional right to demand the end of federal mm-hmm. ownership of land. It's simply historically not true. It's not true. It has never been true. It has never had a precedent of support in any law anywhere in the United States. So what they're doing is really a fantasy. But this has been an issue around range wars going way back. If you watched cowboy movies, for goodness sake, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, there was always the range wars between the sheep herders and the cow people, or the people who wanted to fence land in as opposed to open range people.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. This is this situation, this context, and indeed this history of standoffs that you just related. Yeah, I don't think they really defined or can be defined as terrorism either. I would like to see the word terrorism applied to things like the guy who shot up the Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado.
Yeah.
That was a terrorist act. That was an act intended not only to destroy its target, but to terrorize and intimidate an entire population. That's what terrorism is. This is not. What bugs me about this situation is the lack of an equivalent response by law enforcement because the perpetrators are white.
Well, I think that's true. But I also think there's a strategic question here, how anything like this should have been handled. Ignoring the question, well, he shouldn't ignore it, but putting aside the question of race in this matter, the way to handle something like this is with patience, calm, and always remembering that you have superior force on your side and time on your side. So you can always wait out. You can always wait
yes,
out.
Yes, that's the sort of rational, measured response that always seems to apply to criminals who happen to be white. If these were Black Panthers and they were at a community center somewhere, don't kid yourself that things would play out the same way.
Oh, no question. There's no question. I mean, the way in which the American Indian movement was treated at Wounded Knee, the way in which the Push people were treated in Philadelphia, all of that is very clear. You're absolutely right. The inherent treatment of persons of color as the other is a very major factor. These people are enjoying, and I guess I will agree with you, they are enjoying their white skin privilege, and they are unaware that they carry that white skin privilege. They feel aggrieved and disheartened.
Yes, they're enjoying their white skin privilege, mostly the fact that their white skins are still alive. All right. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, author and researcher Tim Flannery speaks on solutions to the climate crisis. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, an analysis of the legal issues in the case of Timothy Lohman, the police officer who shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice. Also, a discussion about the incursion of corporate agricultural interests as the ICE cracks down on undocumented workers in Monterey County. And a report on the alleged arming of the Houthis in Yemen by Iran. Apologies for my pronunciation. At 11 on stage and studio, Demi Roberts features the world premiere play Broken Promises and talks with Daniel Mahlon, founder of Teatro Milagro, and actor Giovanni Alva. And she checks in with Olympia Akinyogin, my pronunciation, pardon me, of Rejoice, Diaspora Dance Theater, about their performance of Ancestry in Motion. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, we'll hear how women used art and humor to campaign for social justice around the world in 2015.
Yeah, and this is just into us. Our producer, Steve, has handed this to me. He says, today, the FBI is cutting power and installing roadblocks to stop resupply. So what I am advocating is apparently being carried out by the FBI.
Yes. A nice measured response to a bunch of armed guys with guns who took over government property.
Well, I think that again, what I'm arguing is this is a reflection of and an actual action by proto-fascists who are gaining legitimacy and support in the mainstream political situation with the Republican Party. You mentioned Sarah Palin; she's an example of this, but also. The clown Hitler is a real threat to rational American discourse.
Let's go back to the phones. Brian, good morning.
Good morning. So there's two points I think we need to consider here. A couple years ago, I believe it was Amy Goodman, might have been another one. I'm sorry. Might have been another person in the media,
okay,
who reports real news.
Okay.
So, well, I'm on your side, okay?
No. I just another one.
But anyway, yeah. Sorry about that. Anyway, there was a big funding measure by the Koch brothers, and one of the states they targeted was Oregon, and it was they were giving money out for elections and to sway public opinion. I think has resulted, in things. It's never been discussed. I don't think you guys have discussed it very much on your radio show. I haven't heard too many people discuss it. But I think it's a factor in this. Why is Oregon all of a sudden in the light? Second thing is on OPB yesterday, it was reported that the Bundys are all Mormons, and they're radical Mormons. And some of the...
I'm not going to cut you off exactly, but I do want to ask, is that a reliable piece of information? Are these, in fact, the old Mormon fundamentalists with the multiple wives and so on? Because I haven't heard that anywhere else.
Well, yeah, I didn't know that until just yesterday, but there's a quote by... I wasn't listening real closely, but there's one person who's involved in this who calls himself Captain Moroni, and he is he's bound to do this because he saw a flock of geese flying in the air. I mean, and he equates it to Moroni, I guess, who was one of the warriors of the Mormon faith. Etc.
Well, he's one of the angels. Right. I don't want to get into a discourse
on
Mormonism.
No, I don't either, but what I'm saying is, this is incredible. As you sort of take this apart, because it becomes religious fundamentalism, it becomes, if you replace the Mormon vision with a vision of... somebody from the Middle East had with being Muslim, they'd be cleaned out of there in 5 minutes.
Well, sure.
But, and another point I have to make is on public lands, and in a public, they've occupied this public space with weapons. Tamir Rice was 12 years old and had a fake gun in a public space and was shot within 2 seconds. So, how come that a bunch of white people get to arm themselves to the teeth? I can just imagine what kind of weapons these guys have, and occupy a federal government building when a 12-year-old can't even begin to have a fake gun in a public park.
Well, I think it's a good good comparison and a valid one. I also think that I don't know what weapons these people actually brought to the scene.
And thank you for the call.
Thank you. I want to emphasize that people need to find out where these people are getting their impetus to come up here from Nevada when the Koch brothers, promised 2 years ago that they were targeting Oregon as a spot that they wanted to concentrate their beliefs on. And I don't think these guys' beliefs go very far from the Koch brothers' propaganda.
Okay, well, thank you for the call. I don't want to get into a speculation on the various conspiracies of the right. It's not necessary. All one needs to do is to understand that there is, in many different ways, a rising sense of dislike of the government, a misidentification of the federal government as the bad guys, and a very great concern for the notion of individual rights, individual property rights particularly, that has that goes back way back into the 1800s, even into the 1700s, and is now dominating a lot of the political discourse in the country. And the reason why it can do that is because one of the two major political parties is, for purely opportunistic reasons, I believe, giving it legitimacy.
I think it goes a little deeper, though. I think it goes to deeply held notions of what America is and what an American is. And I think that for people who hold this long cherished belief that America is for white people, for Protestant people, and above all, for white Protestant men, they are perceiving a world in which their position at the top is no longer the guaranteed position of privilege and stability that it once was. And this is embodied by the fact that there is an African-American man in the White House.
No, I agree with that.
And this sort of protest arises out of that whole worldview, that America is over, it's done with, we've lost our grip, it's being taken over by the brown people, and by God, look at that black guy with a funny name in the White House. Everything's going to hell. That's where I think this is coming from.
Well, and I also think that the campaign to disenfranchise, literally disenfranchise Obama, born out of this country, closet Muslim.
And delegitimize him.
Yeah, absolutely. Is indeed exactly what you're describing.
And why the need to delegitimize him? Because how could he possibly be legitimate? He's not a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant
man.
No,
I agree with you on that. I absolutely agree. I want to just once more emphasize a local thing that you can do. Today is the day day when testimony will be taken in Ridgefield, Washington, which is only up the road a little bit.
Exit 9.
The highways are clear. The hearings begin, and you can give testimony at 1 o'clock. There's going to be a rally at 5 o'clock. This is an event where you should wear a red shirt. You should show up. Hey, this is really important. These trains will be, if we don't stop them, going directly along the gorge into Vancouver, where they coal and oil and various natural products such as that, flammables, will be offloaded onto ships going up and down the Columbia River and across the very dangerous Columbia Bar. And there are moves afoot by these very same transporters to speed up their rail operations so that the now required 30 miles an hour would be doubled to 60 miles an hour. This is very scary. One of these cars falling into the Columbia River will destroy the salmon significantly for a long period of time. This is something you can win with. This is something you need to fight on. This is something where you need to show up wearing preferably a red shirt. But you need to show up. You need to listen to testimony. You need to make an argument. And by the way, the people who want to build this port are not insane. Their plan is to export this oil because just recently the law was changed in the United States to allow the export of petroleum products. This is, you like conspiracy theories? Here's one for you. This is a great plan to enrich the oil industry, petroleum industry. And it's a really dangerous plan, and you should show up to fight it.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Helen, good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
What I want to say is really the problem started because there were two guys who were poaching, and so they wanted to hide what they were doing, so they took matches and started lighting things up.
Is that right?
Yes. And so then what happened?
That's not how I understand it, but go ahead.
Okay.
Cool. Actually, you're right.
Okay.
So then what happened is one judge gave them time in prison. I don't know how long it was, but it was lenient. And
It was like a one-year sentence, which is less than
a
year.
So then
actually,
what happened is that they were supposed to do 5 years. And so the people from Utah, who are Mormons, they said they'll help them out. And so the people who were going to go to jail said, we do not want to have help. And so the two guys gave themselves up yesterday and went to prison down in California. But the other thing for these people who have come there to do things, other people are sympathetic to them. So they're making a lot of money on this, you know, like a GoFund, not really, but, you know, through Fox News, people want to support them. So it's in many ways a gimmick. Besides, the Koch brothers would like them because if the land can be gotten, then they can mine it. They can do all kinds of things. You know, they like to have all the government land, you know, to do what they want to do. And a lot of people agree with that. They don't believe that land is sacred. So that's it.
Okay, well, I appreciate the information. And just checking into it, it is certainly the case that that these guys did what they did because they definitely wanted to do what they wanted to do on land that belongs to the federal government.
Right, right. And also the land there really was, some people were saying, wasn't good for anything else. And the other reason why it needs more protection is because people would kill the ducks because they want them for feathers for hats. So they've tried to give them sanctuary there. I mean, it's very important, really. Really?
Well, I you're bringing up an important point, which is that this is land that is unique for flyways for wildlife.
Absolutely.
And it's really very important.
Yeah.
And destroying that would be a serious destruction of a vast array of animals, flying animals and otherwise, that go up and down these flyways. It's really, really one of the last wild places in the United States.
Right. And yeah, besides they have the towers for, you know, the telephone and the buildings that are getting taller. It's just, we don't really think about the birds and the trips they have to make and the windows that people have, that they hit on the windows, you know, yeah, in different places. Okay?
Okay, thank you for the call.
Appreciate it. Let's take one more. Caleb, good morning. Sorry. We'll get back to Caleb if we can. Who do we have next, Steve? I guess that's it.
Paul.
Oh, Paul, good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to build on what Helen said. For one, it's not federal land. It's our land. And they.
No, that's really a good point. I'm glad you made that point.
I mean, what they did was they took from all of us when they did that. The other thing is the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And then the reason that these white privileged people get away with murder is because they are very good about calling and faxing and emailing their elected officials. And I think the state police comes under the governor. And if you think that this is our land and you think that these people are doing the wrong things, call the governor and tell her that you want them prosecuted. After the fact, they can take pictures and then go put them on the no-fly list and arrest them later. All they got to do is take pictures of their...
You're right. Listen, Paul, we're going to have to cut you off because we're out of time. I appreciate everybody being here. Sorry to be late, but I walked. I'll see you all later. Now is the time to go to Washington. Now is the time to make your opinion known. Wear a red shirt. Show up. Demand that there be no oil trains on the Columbia River. Along the Columbia River.
We'll talk to you again next week.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on Alternative Radio, author and researcher Tim Flannery speaks on solutions to the climate crisis. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, an analysis of the legal issues in the case of Timothy Lohman, the police officer who shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice. Also a discussion about the incursion of corporate agricultural interests